Welcome, everybody. Delighted to have David Colum, also on X or Twitter, at David B. Colum, on board with us, man of the markets, man of macro views. And what a time to have him on. First of all, David, for the first time, thanks for joining us and welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thrilled to be here, actually.
Recent interesting events and something you've been highlighting is the tenuousness of our system. What's your take on markets, events, and general geopolitics at this key moment?
Well, so I'm a very long-term guy. So if you look at my investing career, it's you know, get it right every 10 years type of an approach. So, you know, and I would say out of the last four decades, I got three of the four correct. In some cases, really well. The roid rage of the last of the teens, I missed. I thought the market had another halving in it in 2009, and so I said, this is a sucker. This is a sucker bet. That can't bounce. And yeah, $30 trillion later, I found myself sitting on the sidelines watching it, and I just in total disbelief. Right now, by evaluation metric, I follow about 25 of them, but I have the markets round number 150% over value, over historical fair value. Anyone who shows you a chart that shows some trend line back to 2020 is a trader or deceptive. I'm fine with traders as long as they know they're traders. I like to see charts that go back 100 years, actually. And I think if you go back to 1980, you're not going far enough back. So,
I love that. Yes. And if there was a decade to get wrong, I think the one you mentioned was it, because, I mean, in truth, for me, that was a depression that just hasn't been recognized as one. I mean, it was a scale banking collapse. It was actually 2 years of contraction, which is part of the official definition of depressions with banking failure. It was all those things, only they massaged the number and they created such a huge amount by percentage, although we've since surpassed that in absolute terms of new money, that it was invariably the disbelief rally, wasn't it? And in fact, I would certainly be quite forgiving for you for getting that that decade wrong. So that brings us to the current decade. What is right for the 2020s, because you're referring to the teens, the 09 through to sort of 17, 18, I'm assuming. How should everybody be participating if they are long mindset and understand also what you just said about overall equity valuation? We've had the financialization essentially of everything, haven't we? It's been a great super leveraging. So you have extreme valuations, property, equity, and many other things. What's the play for the 2020 to 2029, according to the world in your view?
Well, that's a long enough time scale that I'm willing to say that I think you'll get, if you have the urge to buy, you'll get much better opportunity sometime in that window. If you have the urge to not lose money, I'd get out now. The people, there was a panic, what was it, a day or two ago, where everyone's saying the Fed's got to cut. They had Jeremy Siegel, who's such a dork. I mean, if you really want to watch someone rip down Jeremy Siegel, you find a couple of papers by Ed McQuarrie of UC Irvine, an economist, and he just shares Siegel to shreds and says he cherry picks numbers and all sorts of crap. In any event, he was calling for 2 75-point rate cuts, seemingly oblivious to the fact that that would be the beginning of a serious downturn based on historical record. And so I would say that the people called what we just saw a correction have no idea what correction means. You have to correct something to correct. And I know there's technical guys who say a correction is every time you go against the trend. I go, no, you got to fix something. The word correction means fix something. And if we're 150% overvalued, you fix nothing dropping 10%. You fix nothing dropping 20%. You've especially fixed nothing if it bounces right back within a few months. So I will not declare victory. I call myself the most bearish guy on Twitter. I have a few competitors, but I won't start declaring some sense of victory until we're down 50%.
Gotcha.
And I don't think we bounce back. That's the difference. I don't think we're going to see a V bounce. I don't think we're going to do one of these down back up things. I think we're going to do a Nikkei.
Okay. Yes, and that would be a revaluation of all American based, particularly assets, because it's probably the most overvalued equity market of them all, isn't it? So I like the Nikkei parallel because it was essentially I had a career of undermining people who were saying, this is Japan's year. This is Japan's year ever since sort of 1995, right the way through to 2015, only for it now recently only to have made a new high. This, I think it
was nominal high. Nominal high, right.
Nominal, exactly. I was going to ask you for the people, just to hold up the other end of the argument to make for a bit of, I don't want to call it debate because I'm not disagreeing.
Steel Manning.
Yes, Steel Manning and Steel Manning. Those that say exactly what you just said, well, Dave, it's diminished dollars. The dollar of today is not the same dollar of yesterday. It is an inflation part of the stagflation, which means that these equities will be spitting out earnings in, you know, if bread goes from $10 a loaf of bread to $25 a loaf of bread, the bread company will go from, you know, a $5 stock to a $25 or a $15 stock, et cetera, et cetera. And the earnings will be adjusted for inflation. And it's the only way to preserve, it's not the only way, but it's one of the ways I would say they would argue. And that this is just the inflationary element that has to work through the system. Of course, it does seem to be uniquely overvalued in America. And I don't think that argument works for why just one major nation. But how would you respond to exactly that? Because you pointed out that the Nikkei has nominally made it higher, but not in real terms.
Well, that phenomenon makes it challenging to invest. It makes investing in this environment. I can invest much better in a potentially asset deflationary environment. I know how to do that. The inflationary one is very tough because it forces you into risk assets that I abhor. When times get dangerous, risk assets strike me as the place not to be. So they're forcing us out on the risk curve. If we are, let's say, you know, 2x overvalued, which I think is conservative, people say, well, that's just the new normal. Then I said, okay, so the new normal then is going to be half the returns too. Because, you know, right now the Shiller PE is something like 33. I'll call it that number, which means, therefore, the markets are priced to return 3% on a sort of a earnings basis, right? Now, again, valuations always are the price of the market divided by a metric that ought to track the same inflationary pressure. So valuations should not trend, in my opinion. They do trend for a while, but they should not trend in the sustainable future. And so there's never in the history of markets been an overvalued market that didn't eventually become undervalued again. And so, and if we're really 150%, 2x, even 3x overvalued, then the trip back to undervalued is going to be a painful one. And I don't think it's going to be some sudden burst of activity which allows investors to dust themselves off and buy with what cash they saved for some reason. I think it's going to be knock them out of their butts. They get up, knock them on their butts again. They get up, knock them on their butts again until finally, they say, I'm done. I can't take any more pain. I can't play this game. I'm never touching equities again. That will be the bottom.
Yes, we need the Newsweek title, The Death of the Equity Markets, don't we? And some.
But we'll get that. We'll get that within a month if things continue. So it's going to take more than that. It's actually going to take the point where no one even wants to write an article about them, right? There won't be glamorous articles about the death of equities. There'll be, someone said it's when the blood in the street has dried and blown away is when you really hit bottom. So we've been on a roid rage for a serious one since the mid-90s in an upward trending valuation since 1981. This is what people don't actually understand. If you take these valuation metrics, again, they should not trend. There's arguments people make why they should trend, and I go, I don't buy your arguments. I think they're stupid. But if our evaluations should not trend, we've got a real problem. When you actually do the math on them, it turns out over the last 40 years, they compounded, 44 years, they compounded it over 3% a year. That should never happen. That means what happens in the next 40 years, they compounded negative 3% to get back to undervalue. And the answer is that'll be four decades of just total pain.
Is this not also the decline of the American empire specifically, more so than some of the others that could be in hand? That period where you'll go through, does it not go hand in hand with the geopolitical, the hegemony? Is there not a dollar-based event in all of that, a debt-based event, the two going hand in hand? Are we not talking about a far larger malaise and also a knockdown of relative living standards for different geopolitical zones, because it's very specifically the hypervaluation American. I mean, the FTSE is still at 7,000. I moved to London in 99 and Tony Blair was bragging about it being 6,900. And it's actually done 25 years and barely gone 3 or 4%, which is also why some, you know, companies like Cadbury's chocolates and that were bought up by American brands. And obviously, the earnings just got converted into the higher multiple on the American stock market.
Right.
It feels like you're also calling the demise of America.
So my model I just described does not include that. Now, when you throw that in, then it gets ugly. So my model is purely an arithmetic model based on overvaluation. The model assumes that over the next 40 years, that things will be relatively normal and we just get back to either fair value or cheap.
And if things go abnormal,
no, I agree with you, though. If we go abnormal, which if sure feels like end of empire activity, we're starting wars all over the place. Normally, wars, geopolitical events, I don't take seriously. We seem to go right through them for some reason. But now we've got presidents who are demented, followed by potential presidents who have IQs of about 80, followed by weaponization of the justice system, foreign wars on many fronts. We got potential conflicts, you know, the Gaza-Israel conflict, which I try not to talk about because there's nothing to win in that discussion, does pose risk, huge risk to the world's stability. And then you got Iran lurking back there. The BRICS, I know the bulls like to say the BRICS is stupid because the BRICS currency will never compete with the dollar. And I go, that the BRICS is not about the BRICS currency. The BRICS is about reforming alliances. And I had about a two-hour chat with Steve Hanke, who knows currencies like there's no tomorrow. And he concurred with that. He said flat out, no, it really is shifting alliances. You've got 40 countries saying we are no longer hanging out with the cool kids in the Western Hemisphere. We are going with Russia, China, India, and Brazil, Western Hemisphere. But and about 35 other countries who want to join that club now. And that is a fundamental, that is a sea change of a higher order if that continues. And we weaponized the dollar against Russia. Stupidest thing ever. Putin called it perfectly. He says, you ought to be the reserve currency and you steal our assets. What do you expect to happen after that, right? So I'm a bit of a Putin supporter. I think Putin is a tough guy, probably a sociopath, but he's run a very difficult country. He's done so successfully, and I blame NATO 98% for the Ukraine war. And the Ukraine war is a disaster for the United States, in my opinion. And it's a super disaster for Ukraine. It's a super disaster for Europe. And I don't know why the Europeans don't join. Why don't the Europeans join BRICS? That's the question. They should be joining BRICS too.
Yeah. It's only the corruption, the military industrial complex, BlackRock win out of that story. But just going back to the reval, you were saying reversion to mean. To a degree, I feel once you've hyper overvalued, there's that tendency to overshoot by sometimes almost at the same degree to ridiculously.
Well, that defines the mean. That defines the mean, right? That if you don't overvalue, you got to spend statistically half the time below the mean. So if you want to argue that the mean is now a different thing, it's a different beast. This time is different, as the classic phrase. Then have a ball, but that means therefore the traditional returns will now not be the same, right? Yes. If you're going to work at overvalued, you're going to work at under returns, lower returns.
Yeah. And to get that huge cycle of the revaluing of American hypervaluation down, which will overshoot and define the mean, as you've said, undershoot, my apologies, that seems to be empirically perfectly designed around the reduction of significance, global influence, still a big country, not disappearing off the map, et cetera, but nonetheless, not the post-communist meltdown of Glasnost, the one standing superpower anymore. And that could mean quite a bit for dollar hegemony and a lot of debt-based aspects, because if the dollar hegemony eventually gets undermined, and I agree with you, the first thing that's happening with the BRICS is not currency-related. There's still way more dollars proliferated in Africa in paper form and electronic. That's the least threatening aspect. The threatening aspect is the trade, the alliances, the allegiances, the ability to procure, the supply chain, the bifurcation thereof. All of those things are happening first. And actually, the currency will possibly be the last thing that sees something emerge. But everything will be.
And they can go to gold. They can go to gold if they have to, right?
Exactly. And then it doesn't matter what piece of paper you attach to that, it's going to be seen as superior, even if it's brand spanking new. And they'd probably make a museum showpiece of, you know, showing their metal, which I'm not sure America would be able to match, which is something I would do. I often role play this and say, if I were China, and I suspect they've got a substantial larger amount of gold than people believe, because they're the biggest miner and they're also the biggest importer. And as someone who's South African, I know that there's a lot of subsistence mining going on around Africa, and there's a lot of, call it black gold or blood gold if we were to have blood diamonds. And that is literally going via Dubai, melted down, boom, and it's going to Shanghai. It's going at an unbelievable rate.
The numbers that are estimated to be owned by China are way bigger. So, and now the problem is everyone's guessing. So there are prominent guys who say, well, he ought to know, but you know, experts get stuff wrong all the time. So you really don't know. Trying to ascertain what a fact is in the modern era is pretty hard. But there was rumors that China had stopped buying for a while, and then someone else came out and said, no, they didn't, not even close. So China's buying gold aggressively. Russia's buying gold. You know, that's all part of de-dollarization. They're saying, look, we can't trust the dollar.
And that is far more undermining of the dollar, because it undermines the treasuries, which is the other half of borrowing money into existence. People don't seem to tie the debt to the fiat. They think that's, you know, totally unrelated asset classes entirely. And it's the ability for Yellen to create that $1 trillion every 100 days. And there's just not the same buying power behind for the purchases of treasuries.
There's people who flippantly say, well, you know, so we've got round number $250 trillion of unfunded liabilities, which are promises we've made for which if you project revenues forward, you still don't know how to pay them, right? They're not just what we promised, but minus the revenues, which we can project. And so that's about $2 million per taxpayer. People say, well, we're just going to inflate it away. And I said, oh, yeah, you're right. So what you're going to do is inflate away $2 million of your net worth. How is that an improvement? I can defend against other things. I can't defend against inflating away $2 million of my net worth. It's a much more difficult defense. And
it's like chopping zeros off all your notes. You can reduce your debt by chopping all the zeros off the notes, but then the amount of money you have has also had all its zeros chopped off.
And all the people who think they're going to get paid, they're not going to get paid. You know, someone's going to be on the receiving end of these messes. So. And you got Saudi Arabia who might stop buying, you know, U.S. treasuries. That seems a little bit of a question right now. It's clear that Russia and China have given up on our debt market. So then the question, we must be scheduled to roll over, I don't know, $17 trillion of debt in the next year and a half. They're either going to have to go short term, which means they're not going to solve the problem at all. I actually, by the way, take offense at people who say, I disagree with the people who criticize Yellen for not selling long-term debt. They go, when the interest rates were super low, you should have sold long-term debt. I go, okay, so let me see if I got this right. You drive interest rates to zero artificially, and you're now criticizing them for not being willing to screw potential savers who have to buy that crap, right? And so in some sense, putting out short-term debt, I know you would have driven the long-term debt markets crazy trying to buy that much, sell that much long-term debt. But I don't think just because you can drive the rates to zero means you should then turn around and screw everybody. And so I don't want the Fed to lower the rates. I want the Fed to keep the rates up. I think dropping the rates is bad on several levels. I don't think you go below 5% ever, almost. Period.
I have a similar line of thought. The debt markets can't sustain a bid at the moment. We saw the California Teachers Association have to borrow against which a bank was provided against collateral on the basis they couldn't sell. There wasn't a bid and they would have crashed the market. So it's quite clear that no one's allowed to crash the debt market with desperate sales when they were failing to be able to make payments because yield was too low on their assets. They ended up borrowing on a securitized basis. And I actually see the pantomime I see being played out is that the whoever is Fed chair, because we don't know how long that lasts, whether it'll be Powell or Trump, I think if he gets in, we'll probably renew him. I don't know what Kamala will do. But anyway, at some point, the ability to set the rate will be taken away from the Fed chair and the board by the markets taking over. And they will just say, no more, no more. And that's when you start to get an uncontrolled interest rate spike. So I suppose my microcosm analysis is the embarrassment that was inflicted on the Bank of England during the George Soros attack. People think entirely that the Fed chairman sets rates and in the middle, that's true. But at the extremes, there's got to be agreement by the market. If he goes down by by 0.45, 0.5%, he's actually saying, I'm revaluing up our debt. Well, somebody's got to be prepared to come in and buy that up and hold him. And the banks will play that game as long as they're being kept in the loop and they're happy with his management. But there comes a point where they'll say, well, hang on a moment. I'm not holding this turd at this price for too much longer. And that's when there's no one in the room to buy it. And that's when Belgium and the United Kingdom and Japan, all the proxies, are eventually saying, yeah, even though we're your proxy, we're not so sure we want to be going down with you on this one either. And then the Federal Reserve becomes the buyer of last resort and or their balance sheet is questioned and they can't. And we get a super spike in rates that the potential. And when I say a super spike, it doesn't need to go to 11%. You know, it only has to go 1 or 2% or even 1.5%. in a quite short succession, and you're going to have asset failures, debt failures all over the place, people not being able to sell their houses, no new buyers being able to afford the payments, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think of that scenario playing out, a sort of interest rate-related spike, which will obviously potentially even drive the dollar up during that period for a while, but it will kill the debt?
So I actually think all you have to do is drive the market-driven rates back up to where they were a few months ago, which will then, there's a lot of organizations out there who are clinging by their nails saying, look, we just have to get to the point where we can refinance at lower rates. If that's going to save us. And if at some point, all of a sudden you get credit spreads blowing out just a little, all of a sudden, all the zombies in the S&P 500 and stuff, they all of a sudden will say, holy cow, we can't, we're not going to be able to refinance all that corporate debt that we took on to buy back shares and garbage like that and buy stupid companies. And as a consequence, then the failures will begin because they've been hanging on. They've been on a sort of a resuscitate. They've been intubated for the last, I'd say, calendar year on the hopes that this problem that they have on their balance sheet will be resolved by the Fed. And if it's not, then the panic will start, in my opinion. I think the regional banks will finally start tumbling and we'll have the implode-o-meter again, where, you know, every Friday we'll read about three or four regional banks that have somehow been swallowed up by someone. But this time, the Fed is now boxed in by not only inflation, but inflation expectations. Here's an interesting thought. This has been bugging me. They're saying the inflation rate's 3%. I don't believe it. I'm not sure I'd go all the way to the Chapwood Index / Shadowsnaps.com numbers of, you know, 10%. But let's say the inflation rate's 4% higher, right, than they say, because they use goofy metrics like OER. OER is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, actually. That means that if you look at the GDP, since it's inflation corrected, it means we've actually been in a contraction for years.
Yes. Yes, I do feel we're in a contraction. I don't think we fully recovered from the subprime depression. Right. And we had an echo recession. And in fact, when I divide copper by gold, I actually get a linear regression line that is going down. That just talks about the industrial activity relative to the fear of monetary failure and inflation. If I just simplify that chart in that way.
And these juggernaut companies, the Mag 7, a good percentage of the Mag 7, which has been driving everything, they look like shitty companies to me. They're not U.S. Steel, Standard Oil, you know, General Motors of the past. NVIDIA, right? NVIDIA. What is NVIDIA, right? I still don't understand it. They buy their chips from someone else. What is NVIDIA? I don't understand. I think NVIDIA can do a 95% Sun Microsystems swan dive. That's just going to take, you know, $2.5 trillion of market cap out of every pension fund, every retirement plan, everything. Just that one. NVIDIA last week lost something like, on one day, lost $344 billion in one day. I mean, yeah. That's an unbelievable bull in a China shop. Microsoft, their revenues have been mediocre over the last 10 years, whereas their price is up tenfold. There's just, Microsoft's an aging company, in my opinion. Facebook, if it went away today, wouldn't we be better off? Society, right? So Netflix, right? There's so many streamers. Who needs Netflix? Netflix isn't even the best of the streamers. Netflix should be at some point headed for zero or being consumed or whatever. Netflix is poor man's HBO. They stink.
Their financials are very poor as well, actually.
That's right, their content's expensive. Their content's
expensive, then the numbers are terrible for what they charge. On Netflix, I'll give you an interesting headline that's on Zero Hedge today. Knives for Netflix is the headline. I had to laugh. The unusual proposal by German police union chief to reduce crime. Hand in your stabbing knife. And we'll give you Netflix. If that's not an endorsement of it being corporate media entertainment and programming, I don't know what else would be. But that was amusing.
The funniest anti-crime story I think I've ever seen was, I think it was last year, where Chicago requested that the bad guys not kill people between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m.
Can we have a working hours?
A truce from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And then after 9 p.m., go ahead, you know, shoot each other, have a ball.
Exactly.
I saw that.
We've only got a night shift. We can't really keep people. That was the Knives from Netflix story. Yes, fascinating. And to me, NVIDIA hasn't really corrected. I mean, for all the drama and everybody wetting the bed, oh, this is so much. Everybody's become so sensitive and fragile. If I log scale in NVIDIA, which you're making reference to, and I just find it really tough to believe that a company grows in value so much, so soon, so consistently. You literally have to be reinventing yourself almost daily. But the log scale version of what everybody is talking about, yes, it fell from... the high was 140.76, call it 141, and the low, which it's now well above, was 90, 140 to 90. It's back at 103. So 140 down to 103. It's not. I mean, when you look at it on a regular scale, okay. But given how much it's done, you know, that's how it looks on a reg scale. But how's this company changed in valuation from a $3 company in 19 or even a $10 company in 22 to being a $103 company in 2 years?
So here's the problem is multifold on NVIDIA too. First of all, the CEO has a history of doing nefarious things in his past, and so I think you should be leery of that. There are claims, I will say claims, since it's not my, you know, gumshoe investigating, but there are claims that there's over 35 companies that they're using vendor financing to sell their chips. Some of these companies have no need to consume chips. One of them is a cannabis company who's buying the chips. And as they're lending him money and the chips are being used as collateral, this is a real Ponzi scheme here. On top of that, there will be competitors coming in, right? It's not like NVIDIA is going to get to just own that market. Innovation always finds its way. And lastly, I've heard different numbers. I don't know how to think about this, but I've heard numbers as high as like 5,000 new AI startups. And it wouldn't shock me because anyone who can code is probably trying to start up an AI company. And those guys, as well as the mega caps who are trying to get into this area, are buying NVIDIA's chips by the boatload. And the problem is those 5,000 startups that are big consumers of chips, they have no revenue. They don't have any revenue. They haven't even figured out how to monetize this. So 5,000 companies are all of a sudden go belly up. NVIDIA's going to lose that. Microsoft is going to say, you know, we don't need your chips right now. You know, the economy's kind of turning down, so you keep your chips. And NVIDIA's going to do, it's going to look like Global Crossing, I think, by the end.
It's very interesting. Chips seem to be a very nefarious area. As you mentioned, I know they were also used prodigiously in VAT frauds because they are high value and easy to cross and reclaim. All forms of things around. I've heard those same skullduggery of companies being set up that were mass buyers and were using the collateral. Very peculiar stories, almost as if it was being treated as some form of gold, forgetting that they quickly become old and slow relative to the new thing very, very soon. And
it's like stockpiling 8-track tapes, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you get there was also the story that there was a shortage of chips during the pandemic era. And I didn't understand that because, I mean, I understand systems where there's a lot of manual labor. But once you've got the designs, you run the machines, and it's kind of very robot. And so I've often been wondering, where's all these chips been going? Along with the events of the pandemic, I'm a bit uncertain. And of course, we have Elon Musk with his Neuralink that is telling us that he's having successful trials on monkeys. And I wonder how far down the line they actually are in producing a chip for every human being for our future brain transplant. It sounds a bit conspiratorial. It sounds a little bit out there, but there's something that's not adding up for me.
I'm a conspiracy theorist, so you should not feel ashamed to say something's conspiratorial because men and women of wealth and power conspire. So, you know, why would you not propose that they're conspiring again? You know, their lips are moving. They must be lying. The other thing is I think that the whole green energy movement's going to collapse. I think, especially with inflation, you know, the average person wants to be green, but if you say, oh, by the way, it's going to cost you this much more on your energy bill, they're going to go, no, never mind, forget it, bring back fossil fuels. They're going to be begging for nukes. I'm actually fairly bullish long-term on nukes because I think that is the next logical move for society is to actually get their energy from nukes. But I think the green revolution has been a very big grift. I think, for example, I was a believer in climate change until I finally was challenged to dig into it. Literally, when I was finally challenged to dig into it, I'd say it took me about 4 or 5 hours to figure out that the thing was a grift. It really was that fast once you dig into it. there's lies everywhere, but it's a $150 trillion grip. That's what they're projecting to spend. It's a colossal waste of money. It's just one of the greatest scams in human history, in my opinion.
Driven largely by BlackRock, and who's been behind so much, the ESG, and also various other cultural innovations. It does seem that the vampire squid of choice has moved on from the 80s and 90s Goldman Sachs to this new entity that seems like a dark star hovering over our planet. I almost expect Darth Vader to come strolling out in the black cloak, because so much out of BlackRock has been nothing but destructive, nothing but a grift. They've already secured the contract to reconstruct Ukraine. So actually, this entire war of knocking things down is so that we can pay to have them built back up by one particular company that seems to be a mega Halliburton stroke Goldman Sachs stroke quasi-financial contract arranger. At what point, we've had Google and Alphabet and the dominance of YouTube, at what point does anything of an antitrust nature ever reemerge with mega monopolies or oligopolies? It seems we've just forgotten about that, and that the ramping up and scaling up of these surveillance corporations that seem to be high on the hog of government expenditure, because that's the other thing, that you know, on labor stats, I'm jumping around a bit here, but I'd love your take if you can bear with us, I suppose, this narrative for a second. Most of the labor stats was government employees. And I think I heard Daniel DiMartino Booth saying when you counted, there was one category of tourism, the government and this category, which shouldn't really count as private enterprise, amounted up to about 80%. So I'm a bit half-cocked not having my full story, but the notion of hot, red-hot labor, the notion of these megacorps being able to hoover up. And in actual fact, the Mag 7 is only an employer, I was told, of less than a million people in total as well, in terms of being this huge juggernaut of the economy. So they're not big employers. It's small business that actually employs people, small and medium-sized business. So what do you make of this whole new capitalism, which seems to be very two-tier system and oligarchical? And are we right to be asking questions about the sheriff sleeping on the watch there in terms of these monopolies and labor stats, lies, damn lies, and statistics?
Well, the sheriff is now kind of like the equivalent of a sheriff in Colombia, in Bogota, right? There's not really much of a sheriff left. The boom-bust cycle always leads to a shift in wealth. So during the boom, you know, Joe Sixpack starts businesses and creates wealth and does that. During the bust, they all get wiped out. During the bust, the big guys scrape up all the capital, the real capital, you know, the factories or whatever, the products. And then the boom starts again. And for example, the COVID lockdown, any idiot could see the damage that would do. They thought that they could just detonate the economy for some number of months, and then it would just self-assemble, and it didn't work. What we lost were 3 million mom and pop type businesses. They are the connective tissue of our economy. So now it's pure corporate.
Not incompetent. Surely it's intent, not incompetence, though. That was the design.
It absolutely intent. Yeah, you can bet Jeff Bezos was happy with those lockdowns. You can bet that the CEO of Netflix liked him, the CEO of anyone who could order online liked them. If you want to understand the world we're in now, I think you have to stop reading about politics and stop reading about economics and start reading about rising authoritarianism. I think what you will discover is that there's probably a dozen books you could read that would show you that we are in a phase of rising authoritarianism. And authoritarianism is basically where you know, government and corporate interests merge, and the loser is clearly us. The censorship. I'm reading Jonathan Turley's book right now on freedom of speech. And every time the world gets a little dangerous, calls for anti-sedition laws start coming in to save us from ourselves. And and we're there. So we're back in an age of rage, and everyone wants to shut down everyone else's free speech. And so so I would urge people to do things like read, you know, Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, Psychology of Totalitarianism by Matthias Desmet. Hannah Arendt's a tough read, but it's about the Holocaust. Michael Malice's White Pills, very, very good. I want to chat with Michael Malice. I haven't been able to pull that off yet. About the rise of the Soviet Union. Interesting theories running around out there. I'm still trying to piece together that are coming from different directions where one global model is that the mega bankers actually help fund Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin and these guys. And that it's kind of just a red team, blue team thing where they said, okay,
I'll add to that. Many people don't know, and it was a more recently learned fact, because I consider myself a student of Bolshevik Revolution and the wholesale slaughter of Orthodox Christians that seems to be overlooked and not referenced to, which is far clearly a very massive number that transcends all numbers. And funny enough, many people don't know that American troops and soldiers were actually sent to Russia during that period, because the bulk of the Red Russians were around St. Petersburg and Moscow. And there were concerns that from the rural areas that pro-Tsarist, because he was not universally unpopular as has been sold, although he lost control over the media, he was allowed free forces to engage. And then, of course, these Trotskyist, Leninist forces that were funded quickly started spinning tales.
With the help of our media. So Diana West wrote American Betrayal, and she describes how the Red Scare was totally legitimate. So we're taught now that, you know, that it was just McCarthy going bonkers and things like that, and that it was overblown. It was not overblown. FDR's right-hand man was a full Soviet spy, basically. He's the guy who sat with, he was basically his chief of staff. And the Western media, very famous journalists, were writing puff pieces for Stalin to make it seem like it was Skittles, rainbows, and sunshine, and we let the Soviet Union have half of Europe for reasons that are unclear, and it appears as though that this blue team, red team battle that was set up, the mega bankers did as they often do, and that's fund both sides and make a lot of money, and more to the point. I think money gets overstated in this game. I think it's about power. I think it's about neurotransmitters. I think it's, you know, why does the King of France attack Spain, right? Are a million square miles not enough for you? You know, why would you have to take more acreage? And the answer is because, you know, the king is an egomaniac and he wants to do that. So,
power.
It's about power. It's about getting your jollies from power. And so that's what Fauci is. That's what all these guys are. They're egomaniacal crazies.
Now, where I say this cycle is different, because we've clearly had a number of cycles. You had it in the Romans, you know, ever tighter totalitarianisms. The concern that we have as worldwide is that we've had globalization. We're in the global village. And this time, instead of it being one geographic area, it's going to be all over. So whilst I fear that in Britain these riots are to actually create the approval for police to use biometric facial recognition, stop right-wing racists from getting on trains.
It's always blamed on the right. Always blamed on the right.
Yes, exactly. From going to, with lead pipes down the road to beat up some immigrants. The narrative as much that way. They now have the technology, and we are talking in a global village. So this particular cycle of totalitarianism is the reach and the play for everyone. And they've done so much sin, and they are so aware that we've become aware because of the internet, that they have to hold their foot on the world citizenry's throats to remain in power. The greatest concern for people in power is the the retention thereof, and thereby they grab ever more power to ensure that they control the fact that their vulnerability of being at the top of the pyramid is never challengeable. And now we have the technology, we have the globalization of this totalitarianism cycle is going to mean almost the end of, it just feels like an end of times, because who votes once you hold all the power over life and death, and you can enforce medical interventions, injectables, subdermal, and you can take lives of anyone who has wrong think. Who's going to run the risk of allowing someone to live and have free speech that might be critical of them? Is it not invariably leads to the ultimate totalitarianism, where there is just a sheep breeding stock of numbed out brains, and anyone who's divergent has been melted away as a potential threat? The pre-crime is here, all of this, the wrong thing. Are we not in the final stage of a globalized totalitarianism? Do we come out of it? Do we ever get to the Magna Carta cycle again, where, you know, rights to peasants and serfs come back again? Or will we be, is this the final chapter?
Well, I think we're at the beginning of the beginning. I think you're dead right. I don't think you get to pull back. I think we have to basically go through the valley of death and come out the other side. The Soviet Union, it took 70 years to sort of go through the valley of death and come out the other side. And so I would say that not in our lifetime.
I was about to say, even if we ever did, if we're going to run the cycle of the Soviet Union, it's not something me and you will see. We will live out the ever-tightening grip of the surveillance state and the facial recognition, and we will see a tapering, reducing quality of life world by many, many metrics. And it's quite a sad environment for many people who will be watching this YouTube, who are, I mean, even if you're 20, there's no guarantee you come out the other side, especially if it's going to get as draconian as we think it is. You literally might have to be a teenager to have a chance, if we're taking 70 years, of actually seeing the repeal. And I don't know, once they entrench so deep and they have so much absolute power, how do they get it wrong? Maybe that's the totalitarianism to end of a lifetime. And they eventually eat each other. You know, I think the next fight is, it's no longer one of the people. It's the warring factions within Rothschild clan A versus Rothschild clan B that start to look at each other. Because when you're psychopathic, this is almost the territory of Caligula. You know, when you're psychopathic and you have absolute control, you never stop fearing a threat. If you've subordinated the people into brain-chipped drones that quite clearly are absolutely, and everyone else has been cleared up and terminated, you've reduced the population, you start looking at your family members or those relatable that you've worked with that you didn't like as much. The anxiety, the fear doesn't leave with people like this, the psychoticness, and they eventually eat each other at the top to a degree until there's one man.
You probably read Live Not by Lies, right? About the preservation of Christianity in the Soviet Union, and the real trouble started when you stopped teaching your kids the truth for fear they'll blurt it out and you'll end up in a gulag. We kind of have one shot at this. You know, if you want to take real big picture, we are in an interglacial period where the last glaciers were, you know, serious glaciers, the ones that covered where I'm sitting by a mile deep, some number of tens of thousands of years ago. I can't remember the precise number. And there'll be another one coming. And if we don't solve these problems, then civilized hominids will have flourished in one interglacial period. When you come out of the other side, there won't be the fossil fuels. There won't be the means of reinventing a technological society, because we had it good. We had forests, peat bogs, oil, whale oil, you name it, and eventually nukes. But we can't blow this one. We've got to hang on to it. And the world's fragile, right? The digital world's fragile. I've written stuff that's now I can't even find on the internet. It's all fragmented and gone. And I save it on my computer, but and then history. What is history, right? I'm totally at a loss to determine how you say with any confidence that you understand some chapter of history. It seems like it's always being fabricated. They say it's written by the victors. So somewhere,
well, I think that's horrible as well. I mean, actually it has been written and evolved out of that, from especially with many a language, Aramaic to all the other derivatives. It's clearly been fiddled with immensely, and there's been some synchronization. You have to question everything now. And I would say, to your point, isn't it interesting? You should make sure everything and all your articles and thoughts, your best works, are printed, because they are adjusting digitally documents now.
Oh, yeah. They're rewriting history in real time. How will you make sense of the modern era? You know, 100 years from now, when they're trying to figure out what the hell happened now, I don't know how we can't even make sense of it now. I don't see how they're going to make sense of it.
And that's what frustrates me, because how do people actually align with digitization, which is the license to pervert and to transcribe any new meanings into and within, and Caesar was black, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like Netflix is doing, the browning out, the writing out of history of even white Europeans, which is controversial in itself. How do we trust digitization? The more they want digitization, the more I want a physical book, the more I want physical money. We haven't spoken of gold, and we haven't spoken of Bitcoin. And I can't help but think, on the one hand, you have the digitization that wants to be new generational, supposedly unique, that quite clearly looks to have been a dark state project. And then you have physical gold. How would people invest? Bringing it back to, what do people do to at least retain the financial aspects? Are you a gold fan over Bitcoin? Where do you stand on the two asset classes?
Well, I don't own any Bitcoin. I've been watching it since it was, I don't know, a dollar a coin or something. People say, well, don't you regret not buying? And the answer is no, because it would have gone up 5x. I would have sold it for a nice profit, and then I'd be spending those profits on therapy to try to recover from having given up the biggest gainer in history. But Bitcoin, it has my attention. That if you actually talk to the hodlers, I'm one of the more famous non-hodlers. They really think I should own Bitcoin, and they're flabbergasted that I don't because of my worldview. I do podcasts with Max Kaiser Marty Ben, all these guys, right? And
so Pompliano, yes, as well.
Yeah, Pompliano. They're all civil to me, because for one thing, I'm civil to them. I don't say, you idiots. I don't do the Peter Schiff thing.
Look, it's not about calling people idiots. It's just the digitization.
Everything
digital.
So the thing that, first of all, I'm a bit of a Luddite, so, I get pissed off when I can't log into something, and so the idea of putting serious net worth into the digital world is troubling to me a little bit, but I could get by that, because I'm already kind of in the digital world by simply being part of the financial system. I own quite a bit of physical gold. I mean, a substantial, shocking amount to some people, probably 30% of my net worth is gold. And I figure that if the world goes to hell, Bitcoin might be the best possible outcome, but gold will not be a problem either. So it's kind of an attenuated Bitcoin is where I see it. The highs and lows are going to be more controlled. Bitcoin's going to be a bit of a roller coaster. What I will be watching at Bitcoin going forward is that the problem that Bitcoin has right now, it's a revolutionary technology, which is, therefore, it's consistent with the Bitcoin enthusiasts being demographically very young, right? And so you get some of the old guys who like it, but they're kind of reluctant. The real enthusiasts are the young guys. That's what revolutions are like. They're not, 50-year-old guys don't do revolutions. It's the young guys who do them. At the same time, it's produced an investor class that's about as naive as any investor class.
Can I add to that? It's when we say the young guys, it's the young guys that are corralled and for which there are hubs of orchestrators often the most. The number of organic revolutions, I think, is far less than we truly think. And I would say the managed from above with orchestrators revolutions, for which the young are targeted and are the lead sheep to
right.
lead the charge.
Yeah, they are the standing army. They are the standing army, right? So yeah. Bitcoin is rumored to have been started, finds its origins in an NSA white paper written by three guys. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've read. That should give you a little bit of the creeps. I have a feeling that the risk going forward is it will either be absorbed by the system, which means it loses its Bitcoin-ness pretty fast, if that's the case, or they will be destroyed by the system. And the maximalists say, oh, you can't touch us. I go, you just watch. They can touch you. Let's just start with January 6th and say, what did they do to those guys? They didn't do much, and they all went to prison. So no, they can touch you. I guarantee you they can touch you. What I will be watching with great interest, I think Bitcoin has not experienced yet, is a downturn. The last time we had a serious downturn, Bitcoin was a twinkle in somebody's eye. It was this offbeat thing that only a very small number of people gave a damn about. The next serious deflationarily flavored downturn, and it won't necessarily be a deflation, but asset prices will drop. It'll be fascinating to me to watch how Bitcoin responds. Does it act like a risk asset or does it act like a defensive asset? And people say, you know, what price would you buy? And the answer, that's not the right question for me. There will be some moment in time where I will decide that Bitcoin will survive. And it'll probably be a period in time, I'm hoping it's a period in time when it is beaten and bruised and banged up, but I will conclude it survived. And if I'm really lucky, I will time it well and buy it pretty cheap. So that'll be, I don't know what price that'll be, but I've got to convince myself that Bitcoin's not going to be destroyed. And I'm not there yet. And every major decision I ever make, my whole life I've done this, I send it through a filter that says, if this decision you're about to make goes very wrong, will you forgive yourself for having made it? If the answer is no, then I don't do it.
Yeah.
So I apply it to getting married, having kids, going to college, you know, whatever. And my decisions, because the answer is yes. If I would forgive myself for having made that decision that went very wrong, it means my thought process was correct.
Yeah.
And I got to be able to live with that. And so I was one time doing a podcast with Keith McCullough, and I made some reference to being right. I said, unless, of course, you consider performance an important metric. and most of the guys who invest now think that's the only metric. And I don't, actually. I think it's the thought process. I think it's the protocol by which you got to that conclusion. Because yeah. you will in the long run win if you're making your decisions using good protocols.
I agree. And to me, Bitcoin doesn't pass the smell test to be something.
I'm still waiting.
I would speculate in it like a trader and hope to, you know, scalp. But the whole digitization of our world leads to totalitarianism, in my view. And I think its origins is suspicious as well. How to make a mint document, as you referred to, 1996. The timing at the Great Recession. And I would also say the great fairy tale for adults of Satoshi Nakamoto, this benign individual that's disappeared.
Right.
It smells to high heaven.
And it's a Greta Thunberg flavor to it.
Yeah. I've already speculated that at some point BlackRock, who is the new vampire squid or mm-hmm. the dark star hovering over planet Earth, will probably say in lieu thereof safety considerations given quantum computing, they'll assume custody given that no one is looking after the Satoshi wallet and put it towards green endeavors across the planet, yada, yada, yada. And people will slowly accept that. Meanwhile, it will just be the official truth being eventually made that the inherent origin and bulk thereof is owned by the larger families and will advance whatever quangos, special causes, and macro plans that they always had, and they will lend against it for their own wealth if they ever need such a thing. But as we've said, it's all about power, not about money once you're that rich. So yeah, it doesn't pass the smell test at all for me. And I think even capital gains taxation and various other things, there's many ways they will strip out, if it does survive, they will strip out the wealth that people think they may have. So I would speculate in it, but I would not, I don't trust it personally. But, you know, maybe I've made my decision too soon. We will see. The other point is, in the sell-off, by the way, gold hit, I think, around 2,000. Its total fall was 3%, 3.8%. I did the check. In this cataclysmic sell-off, which you and I agree is not such a big thing, and you pointed out nothing's really been corrected at a meaningful level, it's just a bit of news fluff, it fell 3.8%, while Bitcoin fell 38%, from the 71 high down to 48,000. And the problem is, you need your balance sheet and your money at the bad points. It's not when everybody tells you straight after a bull market at its high that you need it. It's the bankers take the brolly away when the rain comes, you know, and it's always at that point. And if you're a high beta asset, which it still clearly is, in spite of its many years of existence, and I will say 15 years is pretty small compared to gold's many millennia, which is more than the 3,000, 4,000 we're told. It didn't stand the test, because you'd have to be a seller on the low end. And imagine you bought at 70, be selling 48.
But it's so volatile. It's been so volatile its entire lifetime that if you can't withstand a 30% drawdown of Bitcoin, you shouldn't be in it anyways, right? That goes with the territory. And so...
Well, I love how it's framed as a feature. You know, this is the thing. The volatility is the feature. No, actually not. In all traditional financial standings, you adjust negatively for a high volatility asset, and you expect a far higher return if it's delivering that, and you work on the basis you're probably going to be shaken out at the lows. Most traders and even investors are shaken out on the lows at high volatility, at those peak moments where you get forced selling. So it really needs to be a small percentage of your portfolio that it's not deemed meaningful when you have that kind of event. That's my framing for it, on an adjusted, risk-adjusted basis. I don't know what your thought is. Should people have a small percent in it, like 5%? Because I'm open to that.
That's a little bit like having a $10,000 life insurance policy, though, right? I mean, one of the questions I've been trying to answer is, let's say you have a hedge against catastrophe. Clearly, if you're 100% hedged and you happen to pick the right one, you're going to be a very wealthy person, right?
Yeah.
But let's say you pick a good, let's say both Bitcoin and gold do well in a catastrophe. What percentage of your assets do you need to have in that asset to come out the other side of the catastrophe even? Not a big winner, just even. What is the downside neutralizing percent? Is it 10%, 5%, 20%? I don't have a good answer, but I sense it's not 5%. So I think if you have now the 5% of Bitcoin, there is an argument that it's one of these, you have 5%, which is functionally the equivalent of, you know, stitching diamonds in the hem of your dress and getting out of Dodge. So if you want to have 5% so that you have a globally mobile asset so you can escape, then 5% is a decent number. But if you're having 5% to save you if the banking system goes down hard, if it goes down completely, you might be wealthy, but if it goes down hard, I'm not sure 5% is going to do you much good. It'll pay for the funeral.
Maybe it's split like 10 on Bitcoin, 50% on gold, and 40%
something like that.
Property, where property can be two properties for 20% in different jurisdictions, that gives you optionality. I don't expect property to do well, But I do expect, because of the leverage, the financial engineering, particularly in America where everybody has super high mortgages, possibly in Europe where most people have paid off homes, you might not have as deep a dip, but it will always serve you in terms of shelter and roof. So maybe one or two for optionality basis, having 40% in homes or places to live that you are the title holder registered.
Well, I have a pretty expensive house. Ithaca's got a very non-volatile housing market. When there's a boom, it goes up 5%. When there's a bust, it goes down 5%. And so I think it, crudely speaking, probably tracks inflation pretty well. But it's big enough.
Your reverse mean thinking will show that that 5% is not the real bust. You're looking at a 50% or a 40% in your...
Well, but again, even in 08-09, Ithaca Real Estate barely nudged. It really... We're living in this little biosphere hamlet, and whereas the wildly speculative real estate markets went bananas, the sand states went bananas, then they tanked like crazy. And Ithaca just kind of was in its own world. And so it doesn't succumb to manias, and it doesn't succumb to busts very easily. So the reason I mention my house, besides the fact that it is an asset that I own, but it is, I could buy a house with the same function in terms of bedrooms and stuff for one third the price. My house happens to be hanging off a 100-foot cliff looking west over Cougar Lake. Right on the lakeside, you know, I can throw a rotten tomato and hit the lake from my deck from 100 feet up. It's beautiful. It's utopia. And at the same time, because of that location, it's three times what that house would cost if you moved it a mile inland. So then the question is, can you call that just a house? And at some point, you have to say, no, that's a bit of an investment in an asset. That's a hard asset.
Yeah.
Because...
So. No, so there's always going to be a wealthy person that will pay for something you choose.
Well, I don't know if there is, but it's a commitment of three times as much money as I needed to for a house. And therefore, you can't just shake it off and say, well, you have to own a house. You don't have to own that house, that's for sure.
I have
to count it as an investment asset.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, it seems we agree on gold and maybe at some point a speculative long-term investment in Bitcoin. But certainly some unique real estate also seems to be in your portfolio. Any last thoughts if you were counseling people that are watching this video? And we've spoken about some dark, creeping totalitarianism and digitization as your enemy, which is sees me push back at everything that is non-physical to a degree. How would you, what would be your three-bullet plan to those listeners that are going through and hearing us? We're not being abundance of joy and sunshine and rainbows, to be frank. And people say, well, you're doom porners, you're black pill, both of you. You just can't agree on the minor details of how it all goes down. But, you're pretty much the same of line and thought. How would you encourage and leave people with something that they can hang on to, things they can do, and some degree of optimism? Because surely there's opportunities that come out of this overreaching statism and totalitarianism for those that see it coming.
Well, to the young people, I would say learn how to spend more, spend less, and save more. So learn how to put it away. As you go through college, you know, you don't, no longer eat sterno food in the dining halls. They give you lattes and stir fry and all sorts of stuff. The problem is it's kind of addicting you to a lifestyle that's unsustainable as a working 20-something. You're going to have to get back to, you're going to have to go back to eating, you know, sandwiches and stuff. To the boomers, I say, look, if you think there's going to be a downturn and you want to buy at the bottom, you have to get out at the top, and that's the hard part. It's hard to buy at the bottom too, because the bottom is always a raging inferno if you want to try to trade it. So in 09, when Jeremy Grantham said buy in fear, it seemed irrational to me, because again, I wasn't afraid because I was heavy cash. I was in very heavy cash. In fact, my best decade ever compared to my peers was the noughts. While while most people are getting ravaged by a downturn from, you know, 2000 to 2003 and then 2007 to 2009, that decade I compounded 13% a year.
Great.
And I don't think anyone did that. So that was great. So that offsets the teens being a 4% compounding while everyone else is partying in the street. The boomers now are confident that they have grown confident they have enough money. But they also, I was listening to Mike Green, who's got his model of, you know, passive flows is not only compelling, but I think he's gotten better. I think he understands the nuance better. And I've had a lot of exchanges with him on this. And I think the passive flow model is going to break. And it's going to break for a host of reasons, one of which is that every good idea, once it becomes widely held, is no longer a good idea. Passive flows are going to fit into that category. And people are saying, well, you know, what's going to stop the passive flows? I go, well, so if the market, for whatever reason, starts selling, and you're a boomer and you're 65 or 70 and you've retired and you go, look, I can't afford to give up 20% of my net worth. I need that. Then now the other problem with the passive flow is that if you own equities, it's not easy to liquidate them. What are you going to do? You're going to say, well, I'm going to sell NVIDIA. I'll get out of NVIDIA. Right. If you are a passive flow investor, it's a one click sell of the entire market, and who's going to buy it and things like that. And so I think once the boomers are look, if I don't sell now, I won't be able to sell. That's when the selling starts. And that's going to be the real painful part. Is going to be many percentages lower than it is right now. And if the last 7% drop scared you, you're too invested. You're
in a no cash. Yeah. And your gold.
Yeah. Well, so my gold, the cost basis of my gold and silver, I bought it over time, but the cost basis starts at $270 an ounce and $3.85 an ounce for silver. So when they go up and down like a yo-yo, it is hard to get bent out of shape when you're looking at, you know, an 800% gain. And also, it's a 700% gain. Yeah, I don't like it, but you don't sit there and go, oh, my God, shoot me now. So it's a cushion. And I urge the young guys not to go down these rabbit holes, because you got to raise a family. You got to learn how to create wealth. You got to build a career. You got to build a life. And if you start reading about 9/11 being an inside job and assassinations of presidents, former presidents by the Secret Service and crap like that, which I believe is important stuff. But if you start reading that crap in your 20s, you're going to get distracted. It's very hard to go change the world when you think the world is not worth changing. So I would stay away from that. I would stay focused on you. I'd be selfish. Stay focused on myself and build.
Yes. I concur very much strongly with that point. It causes motivational issues, particularly mm-hmm. if you're young and you've got other things and cynicism.
They're saying, look, how am I ever going to buy a house? Why am I ever going to have a family? They're already in a bad place. And we haven't even started. So the temperament of the populace right now is very bad. Also, I started mentioning Green. I forgot to mention something. Green says one of the problems we have is that although the markets are not down much at all, people don't trust them. People know they're sitting on an air cushion. They know that these are not well-founded markets. And so I think the panicking will be pretty compelling once they say, okay, my suspicions are starting to look bad. But, you know, there'll be some dip buyers. You know, in 29, the market dropped a ton and then bounced 90% of the way back. And people said, oh, it's all clear. And then they bought it and then they got pounded. And, you know, here's one for you, which I tell every podcaster. If you own the top, you're toast, period. If you own the top, you're toast. If you own the 1906 top, you broke even in 1981 in terms of capital gains, inflation adjusted. If you own the 29 top, I think it's 1992 or 3, somewhere there, on an inflation adjusted capital gains, all you got were dividends. And right now, the dividends are like 1.5%, so you're not going to get shit on those. And so the bottom line is that it is a completely and utterly losing bet to own the tops. Yeah. And then the question is, you know, well, how do you know it's a top? And you say, well, if it's historically the most overvalued market in history, let's start with that, right? and maybe that, maybe that's your first subtle hint. And once the selling starts, everything goes down.
So
that's why I have good ideas that I won't act upon very aggressively, because I they're going to go bad too, in my opinion.
Yeah. So going back to that, gold is actually not the top, despite it being close to highs. And you would say to someone, let's say someone starting now and understands the financialization of everything, is terrorized by the notion of equities taking a century to actually get back in real terms with the true inflation rate. We know there's monkey numbers everywhere. So gold, what would they say? I am saying, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe you'll correct me, but I'm saying save in gold ounces for debt collapse and inflation, stagflation, etc. Would you say that, given that gold is 2,400 and was 240, you know, one-tenth thereof in 2001?
Well, in nominal dollars, they're not that different. my big fear, my big social fear is the historical analogy. You know, talk about Nikkei and this and that. My big social fear is an analogy with the Cultural Revolution in China, where the young turned against the old. And that's what this rising neo-Marxism and these drag queen shows and shit like that's about, is about turning generations against each other. So you have this old guy saying, this is, you know, Dylan Mulvaney should jump off a cliff, where the young guys think, well, Dylan Mulvaney's just a transgender person, blah, 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 blah. They defend the person. It's fine, but you're actually being teed up to profoundly disagree with your parents. You hear stories of kids doing biomedical interventions to be transgender without their parents being consulted, right? This is a cultural war at this point.
I agree with that, but I would say it's not just multi-generational. Maybe you feel it as someone who's of the boomer generation particularly, but it's actually between the genders. It's the confusion about genders. It's the between the races. It's between the ethnicities. It's between the language. They are dividing and slicing and dicing everybody into categories, right wing, left wing, black, white, you name it. And you might kneel on more than another. But at the end of the day, this is the cultural Marxism. It is defragmenting us instead of being a community of humanity.
Making us tribal.
Tribalization by gender, by thought process, by logic, by language, by you name it. And it seems a very good management tool for the masses to, if you keep them infighting and you seed dissent all the time, you are actually keeping them in their box because they're too busy. The crabs are too busy pulling each other back down into the bucket to let any of them escape.
There's a psych study where they put monkeys in a cage and they hung a banana, and every time a monkey went for the banana, all the monkeys got shocked, and pretty soon the monkeys started pulling any monkey going for the banana, they started pulling them back, and they would substitute in a new monkey, and you reached a point in the experiment where there were no original monkeys, yet they were pulling each other down from grabbing the banana, which is basically a cultural evolution of don't grab the banana. Very tough times. And, you know, if you look at, again, I don't think politics normally makes a difference, but it feels like it is going to make a difference this time. It feels like the world's in a state of turmoil. It's very end of empire behavior. They say that the past empire's gender ambiguity kicks in amazingly enough in previous eras.
Weimar Germany. The parallels with Weimar are, you've got the gender, the dysmorphia, the all forms of perversion, inversion that was going on in Berlin just pre-Hitler. You've got the currency destruction. it's quite spooky, actually. And you've got the communism, you know, in essence, resisting the Marxism was his Hitler's. Mm-hmm. We've got to be careful just by mentioning that. But
I know.
I find it unbelievable. What's the
opposite? The other assumption is that somehow we have, by virtue of being the modern era, we've transcended these human frailties which we read about historically, and there's no evidence of that. Right? There's no evidence that we're somehow now above the mistakes of the past. We will repeat them. And but now you want an optimistic view. Well, optimistically, we could be wrong. Optimistically, this could be a phase. Like the 1960s in the United States was a very turbulent phase. And it gave way to the 70s inflation, but eventually gave way to the 80s and, you know, the new dawn and you know, the you know, all of a sudden out of the blue, people started wanting to create wealth and make money and feed their kids. And they were no longer screaming about foreign wars and inflation and stuff like that. So this too can pass. But history also shows that there are times where empires do slide into a state of decay and do not readily retrieve. Victor Davis Hanson wrote a book about 4 collapsed empires, which I have trouble remembering well. First one was Thebes, second one was Carthage, the Aztec one, which I never can pronounce, and then there's a 4th. They're shockingly quick. When the empire decides it's time to go, it really goes pretty quickly. They don't think they can be beaten. They think they're invincible. Like I think it was Thebes, 700 years, no one had been able to breach the walls. And then they fell in a day and a half, something crazy like that. The opponents, the people attacking the empires, they start out thinking they have to beat them. This is the spooky part to me. They start out thinking they have to beat them, but then they realize, look, if we beat them, but we leave them intact, they will become a problem again. And so we have to exterminate them.
Yeah.
And that's a decision that is made in the middle of the battle, where you go, holy shit, we can't just sign a truce with these guys, because in some number of years we're going to be fighting them again. So they rub them out, they exterminate them, and I've been having thoughts, and I'm not going to go there in detail, but I've been wondering about Hitler's anti-Semitism, and you know, clearly he demonized the Jews to achieve some purpose. But I'm wondering if there was a deeper motivation, it's probably been written about, and I just got to find the guys who wrote about it. But I'm wondering if he had some strategic plan that was more than just him being a twisted psychopath. And it's such a dangerous even topic to talk about. I'll talk to friends, you know, off record and stuff about it a little bit, but there, he might have had a reason that, albeit twisted, because killing 6 billion people is never not twisted. But there might have been some thinking, which you say, for example, Hitler in some sense. I mean, it's dangerous, but in some sense, Hitler makes more sense to me than Stalin, because Hitler turned against a very specific group and demonize them in a way that leaders often do when they need to rally the populace around a cause. Stalin seemed to just eat his own country alive. I mean, Stalin just doesn't make sense to me.
But Stalin, inside of that country, it was one particular group of people that were dominant. And even though he's portraying of not being that group, I suspect he was, because they changed names. I visited his birthplace in Georgia. So people think he's a Russian. First of all, he wasn't.
Are these the Khazarians in Ukraine? Have you ever heard of the Khazarians in Ukraine?
Yes.
How do I read more about them?
I would suggest actually a book, 1666, which actually is leads to eventually that, where they discuss Zabotar Zevi, who was the proclaimed by Rabbi Nathan of Palestine, Gaza, Palestine, currently in the news, as you're aware, and known as Palestine at that time, and part of a small percentage of Jewish population, declared Zabotar Zevi the son of God, who declared himself, I think, twice before, no one believed him, And eventually it was the second or the third attempt that, no, he got a bit of groundswell support. 1666, read that book, it's fascinating. And he goes on to get a large following, a Judaic following. And then eventually he turns and he becomes Islamic and penetrates what was secular Turkey and became part of the Young Turks. And the, what do they call it? The Sultan was actually overthrown by generations of him. And it was the penetration, the Trojan penetration of Islam. That's fascinating. And I think it sets up that whole Caucasus that then leads into Ukraine, because there was I think they called it the Crescent. There's a name for it, where Jews had been pushed out of Russia due to people's beliefs of certain practices that probably warrant a different conversation, and they lived in there. But they penetrated Trojanly also what is now modern Turkey, and Atatürk and many of these heroes that made it a secular society are actually forks of that particular chain, as are the Saudis. So you have this sort of frenemy situation of Saudi and Israel, which doesn't exist with Iran and Israel. And it's very interesting. They are forks in the chain of lineage that have actually penetrated different religions. It's fascinating. You'll see the world in different eyes there when you see that, like Christianity, they've been penetrated and perverted, the great faiths. And 1666 was it. And of course, his followers, Sabbatai Zevi's followers, were stunned when he then, you know, the Messiah, he preached himself as the Messiah for Jews, then changed religion. So some of them followed him and penetrated.
Now, did he change religion or did he fake the Judaism?
Well,
was he a faux Jew at the time? Was he a faux Jew at the time?
No, I think he was potentially can't answer that. It's not clear from the book. But he probably was a faux Islamist once he converted. Okay. In much the same way, during the Spanish Inquisition, you had faux Christians that were forced to convert, also given practices. They were either killed or chased out, because there'd been expulsions for practices across Europe many, many times. And there you can go and check the history of expulsions that are with that particular tribe. But that's an interesting discussion almost for another time.
I know. What this all illustrates, though, is that humans have been savages with each other just almost nonstop. One of the things that scares me a little about the U.S. has been so long since we experienced that personally that I think we've gotten complacent. We don't understand why we should not touch the flame, right?
I fear so much that actually those same forces, that particular ones that are very, very more prone to certain activities, are ready to bring it to the U.S.
I agree.
That's a great concern. And the West as a whole, but America as the fulcrum, the Amalek, or the crushing of America with great cruelty. Because if you only have to go read the Bolshevik Revolution to see what was done to the Orthodox nuns and priests in brutality, it wasn't death. It was ritualized torture, burning to death, which involved crucifixions, cutting the back of hands and nailing it to the altar called the glove. It was burning ash, put in orifices. It was occultically ritualized torture of great imagination. We've got to be very, very careful with a particular kind of enemy that could indeed be inflicting similar. And they took great glee in it. And Stalin, rather than he was eating himself and his own people, was part of a group that was having vengeance wrought upon them for resisting First World War participation and the Romanov family's previous activities that had expelled groups of people. So they are from the Caucasus. You might know the Chechens, for example, that are Islamic, and they have many generations of feud that they hold as grudge perpetually. Well, think of the non-Islamic version of the Chechen stroke Khazarian that has that same, only multi-generational, that they are still in their mind looking to exact a revenge of the Roman Empire.
The great thing about the U.S. turns out to be, I think, is that compared to other regions of the world, we don't have this long memory and long-standing grudges. There are some, you know, there's the slavery and things like that, but they pale in comparison to cultures where there's guys who will go to war because something was done to them 800 years ago, right?
I mean, it's insulated in your society are people that do. It's not that you yourself don't and the average person doesn't and you don't have history on that territory that doesn't. If you are projected to be the descendants of white Europeans, you carry those alleged sins of those events.
I'm told.
You're told. And apparently, just by virtue of being born with certain genes, you have all forms of crimes to be paid for that extend millennia back. And that's
what they're trying to do. They're trying to do that, but I think a lot of people are resisting accepting that yoke.
Yes, that's the key thing to reject it. Dave, it's been fantastic talking to you. There's so much more we would have a great fireplace chat one day, potentially personally. Looking over the ledge, I will throw your rotten tomatoes from the balcony into the lake below. And enjoy it with great glee. But thank you so much for sharing with us. How do people engage with your work, your opinions, your views, and how best should they find you?
David B. Collum on Twitter, C-O-L-L-U-M, David B. Collum.
Do you write anything from a blog point of view?
I write one blog a year. I write an annual year in review. Part of it's to capture the year, you know, because we go through each year thinking we'll remember it. Then it becomes a... Do you have kids?
I do, yes.
You swear you're going to remember every inch of their childhood, and then it becomes this distant memory. And so so for me, my year review is kind of like a Doogie Howser thing where it's like a diary for me. And at the end, but it's not the short-termism of every day. And people say, well, why don't you write it quarterly? And I go, because it takes me longer than 3 months to understand what I'm looking at. And so once a year works for me. Problem is I have to write it, therefore, at the end of the year. I collect the information, but I have to write at the end of the year. Then it runs 200 to 300 pages. So I can assure you it is a cathartic experience trying to write this thing at the end of the year that's 300 pages long. I think it's funnier than hell. I try to take on subjects that people don't touch. I do not want to talk about something that everyone else is talking about. I do not want to take a stance that is a majority stance. And so it's not that I take the other side. It's that I write about the things for which I find myself on the other side.
I love it. I find myself envious of it. It sounds like a diary of a lazy, smart man. Because you should be doing it daily. You decide, what the hell, I'll scribble a couple of notes and capture it at the end of the year.
I scribble quite a few notes. I mean, by the end, my notes, I just paste into Word files, links, paragraphs, quotes, you name it. And at the end, it's 700 or 800 pages of notes.
Wow, fantastic. I'm motivated to watch those, and I look forward to your summary of this year, 2024. Dave Collum, thank you so much for joining us.